He has a website. Let me tell you the exact website. You go on, and he has like 17,000 different AA speakers that you can download, any speaker, for free. He also does our Thursday night movie nights at the Osceola County Intergroup. And I can tell you a lot more, but I'm just going to have him come up and stuff. Mr. Willie, come on up.
There we go. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you. And we've got a nice way of closing. Oh dear, this is another first for me, and I'd like to thank Scott for asking me a few weeks ago, and the committee that asked me to come and speak here tonight. I'm pretty breathless, just bear with me. I've known Scott now for 7 or 8 months, and Scott knows that I'm a man of very few words, so they have allowed me to speak for 3 hours tonight. My name is Willie Burns, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic, and we'll get into that later on. I find it very reassuring to know that I'm the only person in the room that doesn't have an accent. Apart from Chris and Harry at the back. I used to go to meetings with them in Scotland years ago, and I'm glad that they're here tonight. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it with all my heart. You know, my whole life today centers around AA, and I'm very grateful for that. I have no idea what I'm going to say, but I know what I'm going to talk about. You know, I never try and pre-plan anything I'm going to speak about at a meeting, but you're not going to be subjected to a drunkalogue, I can assure you. I would love to stand here tonight and say that from the very first time that I came to AA, that I never had a drink. And everything in my life was wonderful. But that's not true. What is true is that the worst part of my life, the worst part, started after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was bad enough when I came here the first time. I probably qualify for the Guinness Book of Records for the number of times I went in and out the doors of AA. Just to give you a brief, and it will be a brief, sketch of what I used to be like and what happened and what it's like now. I was born into an alcoholic home. Both my parents were alcoholic. I was the only boy in a family of 6 girls. And I love to tell people that I was 3 times as unfortunate in life as Cinderella. She only had 2 ugly sisters. Yeah. I'm glad I'm not here tonight. Yeah. That's why I'm only 5'4". They kept hitting me on the head. Anyway. Because of all the drinking I saw at home for years, and the arguments and the fights that went with it, you know, I remember in my early teens I vowed I would never drink. And I meant it. You know, I couldn't wait to get away from home quick enough, you know, to get away from all that carry-on that was going on. It wasn't very pleasant. I left school, high school at 18. Within 6 months, I was married. My wife, she was only 16 at the time. And within 2 years and 10 months, we had 3 children. She had them. Okay? She was a very, her family were very devout Catholics. And I didn't know that after my youngest child was born, our married life was finished. That was it. And at that time, I was working down in London. You know, this is the early 60s. You know, the days of the permissive society, and, you know, and I can assure you I was. I didn't start drinking till I was about 21, 22. I'm not too sure. Reason. I remember when it was. It was at Christmas time at an annual staff dance, and one of the guys, you know, they were handing me glasses of beer, and I tried it and I didn't like it. Somebody handed me a pint of lager and I sipped that and I didn't like it. Eventually a guy handed me his glass and it had whiskey and Coca-Cola in it, and I fell in love with the stuff, and that was the start of my drinking. My drinking, it didn't last too long, maybe 6 or 7 years, but every night when I would go home from work, and I worked in the gambling industry, every night when I would go home, it was always the third degree, you know, from a wife. Where were you? Who did you see? What did they say? Where did you go? You know, and it got to the stage that I didn't want to go home at night, because I knew it was going to happen. I'll jump forward to 1970. There was quite a number of people were concerned about this wee guy's drinking. And my ex-wife and her family, they arranged for me to go and speak to a man who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was a Catholic priest. And I can mention his name now because he died a few years ago. And his name was Father Isaac McLaren. I'm sure Chris and Harry will remember him as well. But I remember that evening I went over to see him, and it was about 30 miles from where I lived. And we're sitting in a big room in 2 armchairs across from one another. And he started telling me about his drinking. Then out of the blue, he said to me, "Willie, do you think you may be alcoholic?" And I felt insulted. I really did. Alcoholic? And I'm sitting there, you know, the good suit, collar, tie on, pockets full of money. It wasn't my money. It was my employer's that stolen it. You know, and I remember saying to him, you know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I've got too much money. And he said, "Well, just keep drinking, son. It won't last you long." You know? And again, you know, I remember coming back at him and saying, you know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I don't drink cheap beer and wine like the down and outs in the streets. It's nothing but the best for me. I only drink Bells and White, Bells and Grouse, and Glenlivet whiskey. And that's when he explained to me that alcohol is not a drink. It's a drug called ethanol or ethyl alcohol. And like every drug on the market today, there is a certain proportion of the population who will have an allergic reaction to that drug. And he said it's the same drug, alcohol. It's in the cheapest beer and wine as what's in the most expensive whiskey. And again, the degree of denial in me. Again, I remember saying to him, "But I can't be an alcoholic. I'm far too intelligent." I was in charge of 40-odd betting shops in the London area at this time. And he looked at me and he said, "Yes, Willie," he said, "you're so effing intelligent, you can't count to one." He said, "If you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk." I couldn't wait to get away from the guy that night. And you know where I went. The nearest bar. That's where I went. A year after that, I'm sure it was July of 1971. I remember coming out of the office that night with all the staff, and we went across the road into the Ingram Hotel in Queen Street in Glasgow. You know, and I never drank in any public bars. I was a snob. It was downstairs in the cocktail bars with the Dolly Birds with the mini skirts. That was my parish. Thank you. I remember being in the bar that night. I remember at 11 o'clock at night when it was closing time, when we were leaving there. We all bought loads of booze and we were going to a party away in the far end of Glasgow. I remember being at the party that night. I remember coming out of there, maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was pouring down with rain and I could hardly even stand. And I remember some of my friends gathered around me and they were pleading with me, you know, Willie, don't drive this car. Because I lived about 30 odd miles away and there was no motorways at that time. It was all like country roads. And some of them even tried to take my car keys off me. You know, there's no way anybody will take my car keys, you know. I got in the car and I started driving that night. That's 40 years ago. And up until right now, I can't even remember what happened. My next recollection is being given the last rites by a Catholic priest. My next recollection after that is a big black doctor standing over the top of me and he's asking me a lot of stupid questions like, do you know what your name is? And I told him. And he said, do you know where you are? And all I had to do was look around the bed, the hospital bed that I was tied into. And I said, yeah, I smashed the car up. And he said, that's right, son. It's a matter of medical record that I had over 250 stitches from there up. My ribs were broken. My pelvis was broken. My right thigh was broken in 4 places. My right shin was broken in 3. And I broke every bone in my right ankle. My left leg was broken. Both arms were broken. My right wrist was almost severed off. They had to tie the tendons together under the skin. And they told me at that time that I would never walk again without a steel caliper. And I would never straighten my right arm and use my right hand again. And again, my attitude all my life was, I'll show them. I'll show them. I was in the hospital for 4.5 months. I ended up with 2 chest expanders, one tied onto the top of the bed and one onto the bottom of the bed, day and night, just going like that. And I straightened my arm and I can use my hand. And as you can see, I don't need a caliper today to walk. I've got one high heel. But if I didn't tell you that, you wouldn't know. Okay? I was transferred from that hospital to another one. Then eventually they allowed me home, still with the traction on my right leg. I was housebound. I couldn't get out of the house for a year. Then I was fitted with a proper steel caliper that went from the groin right down to the heel, I'm sure. I had to wear that for another year and I was going to physiotherapy in the meantime, 3 days a week. So for a period of about 2 years, I couldn't get a drink. I was confined to barracks. Eventually I got back to work. And eventually I started drinking again. And the drinking just progressed because this is a fatal, progressive illness. It'll kill us, whether we're drinking or not. Eventually I get back to work. The atmosphere at home, it just went from bad to worse. Again, I remember, you know, there was a couple of AA members came to my house one Sunday afternoon and they picked me up and they drove me about 30 miles away to my very first AA meeting. And I remember it well. It was in the Red Cross rooms at Auchin Gramont Road in Hamilton, and it was a big room, and I've no idea what the person that was speaking said, but the second part of the meeting, when they started going round the room and everyone was commenting, it seemed to me that they all knew about me. They were all talking about me. And to show you just how clever I was, I'm sitting there and I'm racking my brain trying to think, how did they know? How did they know? And then it hit me. When I've left home, she's been on the phone to them and told them all about me. And they've got together and they've said, now when it's your turn you say this, and it's your turn you say that. That's how sick I was. That's how paranoid I was. I remember at that time they suggested that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And to the best of my recollection, I did that. I went to the 90 meetings in 90 days. My life at home didn't really get any better. Our bedroom had become a battleground. I remember at the end of the 90 days, I was taking my wife and the kids down to visit her parents. And I stopped at a liquor store. And I said to her, well, that's it. I mean, I've been to the 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm cured. I'll just go in for a quarter bottle of whiskey. And at that time, she didn't go ballistic like she normally did. She just said, she'd been to Al-Anon by that time, Gerald. She just said, well, if that's what you want to do, you carry on. And I didn't know that that quarter bottle of whiskey was going to be the start of me going in and out the doors of AA for the next 12 years. And during the next 12 years, I never got another 90 days. Nothing like it. And the people in the rooms that I'd heard them talking about the yets. When I went to AA at first, I still had my wife, my kids, my home, my jobs, and a couple of businesses. Over that 12-year period, I lost everything. I lost my wife, my kids, my home, my job. I lost any sense of self-respect or dignity or decency. I lost the love and the admiration of my family or friends. You know, I did quite a number of one-night stands in police stations. I got banned for drunk driving twice. I tried to commit suicide on several occasions, and they weren't half-hearted attempts. I just didn't want to go on anymore. I didn't want to go on. You know, it's as if I was trapped in a long, dark tunnel with a no exit sign at the end of it. I couldn't see any way out. But the only thing that I did right during that 12-year period was I kept going back to AA. I kept coming back. Because I knew that there had to be an answer. Even for a lunatic like me. And I thought it was all right. You know, to give you an idea, and this is not a criticism of the meetings in the west of Scotland at that time. These are observations based on my own personal experience. And I'm sure Harry and Chris can vindicate this. At that time, there wasn't any talk of the big book in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of the meetings, anyone who mentioned God or higher power, you know, or Jesus Christ, you were asked to leave the room. And I was one of those guys as well. You know, anybody mentioning God to me, the hairs in the back of my neck would go up, and I'm ready to go for your throat, literally. You know, don't talk to me about your gods. Because up to the age of 42, God to me was a sadist, and he didn't know it. And he'd been punishing me for years for the way I'd been living. It wasn't until after I got sober that I realised the truth of that statement. And the truth is that Willie was a masochist and I didn't know it. I'm an expert at punishing this wee guy. You know, I hated me like poison. The worst part of my day, every day, I'd be standing in the bathroom in the morning getting shaved to go to work, and I'd look at the innocent faces of my three kids and my wife, and it used to tear the guts out of me. And I couldn't stand it. And the false pride that I had, I couldn't tell anybody about it. You know, and even on occasions, people would stop me and they'd say, you know what I think of you, pal? And I had the same answer for every one of them. And I'd just jump right down their throat and say to them, I don't care what you think of me. Nobody thinks less of me than I do. That's just the way I felt. I remember the night of my last drink. My last drink lasted 17 days, and it cost me about $300, and that was for bottles of whiskey. It wasn't for food or anything else, just booze. I'd just come out of court. I'd been banned for drunk driving for the second time for 3 years, so I couldn't drive, and I stopped at a liquor store on the way home, and I got some booze, and it lasted 17 days. The guy that owned the liquor store, he used to bring it around to my house. Because I would phone him up and say to him, he's a Pakistani gentleman. And I'd phone him up and tell him, you know, bring me a bottle round here right now. And the poor guy would be saying, but, Willie, I've got a business to run. And I'd say, what do you mean you've got a business to run? You get round here right now, pal. I'll come round, I'll wreck your shop. And the guy used to bring it to the house. That's how I got it. I had my last drink on the 23rd of March, 1985. And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. I remember I was lying on the edge of the bed and I was bringing up pints of blood. And I believe that that's the only time in my life that I said the most honest prayer that I had ever said in my life. And I remember saying, God, for F's sake, help me. The next morning there was another EA member came to my house, and his name's Andy Davidson. And I thank God to this day for Andy, because when he came in, he brought his copy of the big book with him. And this is the third edition, the one that he had. And Andy sat with me, and Andy wasn't years sober. He was only about 15 months sober. And Andy introduced me to the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And right in the very front cover, it tells me that this is a textbook. And a textbook is a book to be studied and referred back to. He said, sure, you can read it through once, won't do you much good. He says, this is a book you have to study. Then the terrific hope that he gave me that day was, he opened the book up, and on the very first page it says, big letters, Alcoholics Anonymous. And right underneath it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Past tense, recovered. This book mentions the word recovered in there about 12 times. And Andy was quick to explain to me that the word recovered doesn't mean cured. Tells me that in the book. But all we have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. The word recovered just simply means to get well. To get well. And then he took me to the forward to the first edition in the book. And in there it says, you know, it gives us the reason why they wrote the book. So they wrote it to show other alcoholics precisely how they have recovered. That's the main purpose of this book. Then he turned to chapter 5. And I'd been at hundreds of meetings over that 12-year period where they usually read out the extract from chapter 5. And in chapter 5 it tells you that not everybody in AA is going to make it. Because in chapter 5 it says, those who do not recover. So there are those who will, and there are those who won't. And at the end of the extract from chapter 5, you know, it finishes with the three pertinent ideas, the ABCs. You know, A, that we were alcoholic and we couldn't manage our own lives. And B, that probably no human power could relieve their alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. And Andy showed me the next line in the book. The very next line. And there it says, being convinced we are now at step 3. That's in chapter 5. And Andy looked at me and he said, so where are step 1 and step 2? I said, I don't know. They said, well, they're in the first 4 chapters of the book, in the doctor's opinion. He said, chapter 5 only tells me how to take step 3 and step 4. I didn't know that. Chapter 6 is called Into Action. It tells me how to take step 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I didn't know that. And chapter 7 is called Working with Others. And it's a full chapter on the 12th step. And I didn't know these things. And Andy suggested to me that I start and study this book no more than 2 pages a day, and to believe every word in it. And in all honesty, standing here tonight, I never at any time set out to try and memorize any parts of this book with the intention of going to the meetings to try and impress people. But over the time that I've been sober, and with the number of people that I've worked with on a one-to-one basis taking them through this book, there are vast chunks of it are ingrained in there and in there. I became the 4th member of the very first big book study group in the west of Scotland. There was only 3 other guys in the group. there was Andy Davison, there was Felix Mullen, there was Tommy Docherty, and I became the fourth member. And they all used to come to my house every day, because at that time I was unemployed and unemployable. I'd been banned for drunk driving. I was living on welfare. I'm the guy they wrote this book about. You know, I had so many problems that I despaired of ever solving them. But the guys all used to come to my house every day, and I needed all that support and that help and all that encouragement. I'd sat at home studying this book on my own. In the early part of my sobriety, I'd managed to borrow some cassette tapes of Joe and Charlie. I'm sure you've all heard of. And I'd be sitting there with the book in front of me, as Joe and Charlie suggest, and I'm listening to them, and they're telling you the pages they're talking about, and they underline the parts that are relevant to me. And some of the things they were talking about, I'd read it 30, 40, 50 times. But listening to these guys explaining it, it made it sound so simple. And I'm reproaching myself, thinking, shit, how did I not think of that? You know? It's incredible. I remember when it came time for me, you know, in the first step in the program, it says that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. The first step doesn't ask me to admit that I'm an alcoholic. Because I'd done that for years in the rooms. My name is Willie, I'm an alcoholic. I thought that was the first step. No. You know, the first step asked me to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol. I found out what makes this wee guy powerless over alcohol, and it's in the doctor's opinion, and it tells you there, you know, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, and although they can admit that it's injurious, after a while they can't differentiate the true from the false, and that we're going to go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution never to drink again. And that's when I'm sober. You know, those three words, restless, irritable, and discontent. That's the story of my life, in three words. I also found out that I suffer from an allergy. My body is allergic to alcohol. I'd heard people in the rooms talking about that for years, but I thought it was just a plausible excuse. I didn't believe them, and I certainly didn't trust the people in AA. Most of all, I didn't even trust myself. You know, but going on and studying the doctor's opinion, you know, I found out too that I suffer from a mental obsession. This book talks about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That's me. Is that someday, somehow, I'll be able to do two things. I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. The book says the persistence of this illusion on the mind is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. And that's the way I was on the night of my last drink. I just didn't want to go in anymore. But this is the hope that Andy gave me. You know, this, as I said earlier, this illness will kill us stone dead. And Dr. Silver says that. You know, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. And I thank God that it says a spiritual basis and not a religious basis. If it would have said religious, you'd have a different speaker here tonight, I can assure you. So that wee bit of it made sense, that my life was unmanageable. My life was unbearable, I can assure you. You know, then they asked me, you know, to come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I didn't believe in a power greater than myself. You know, I'd been brought up Catholic, and I'd been brought up to believe in this God of hellfire and damnation, that I was going to roast in the bad fire, and I knew that since I was that size. You know, me and God parted company when I was about 12 or 13 years of age. You know, even speaking to Andy about it, and Andy kept talking to me about a loving God, and I couldn't comprehend this loving God. You know, the one they talk about in the second tradition. But again, I thank God for this book, because this book has saved my life on so many occasions. And in there, when it, in step two, it says, you know, we don't even need to believe. We just need to be willing to believe. And again, in there it says, you know, that, you know, God doesn't make too hard the terms for anyone who seek Him. And as far as I was concerned, in my case, what seemed at first a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving hand of God. And my attitudes began to change gradually. And I began to believe in a loving God. You know, I was desperate to believe in it. Because otherwise there was no hope for me. None at all. You know, and again, thank God for the book, because in there it tells me that I can choose any God, any conception of God that I like, providing it makes sense to me. And even today, it does not make sense to me to believe in a vindictive God. You're welcome to Him. Not for me. As I say, this book saved my life on so many occasions. It came time for me to take the third step. And I remember kneeling down on my own in my bedroom, because I lived on my own for years, I still do. And I read out the third step prayer in the book. And in there, you know, it says that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives. That was explained as my will is my thoughts and my life is my actions, over to the care of God. And Andy told me, he said, "Well, Willie, if you do that, He's going to care for you. Do you believe that?" And at that particular time, no, I didn't believe it, but I wanted to believe it. And in chapter 5 it says, we stood at the turning point. We asked His care and protection. So He's going to care for us and He's going to protect us with complete abandon. Then it came time for me to take the fourth step. And I got to the example in the book, you know, the one with Mr. Brown and Mrs. Jones, and that didn't make sense to me. So, if you believe in coincidences, here's a belter for you. That very first Catholic priest I was sent to see 12 years previously, and at that time he was about 30 miles away from where I live, he had been changed. The parish that he was in was less than 1 mile from my house. It was at the bottom of the road, and his name's Father Isaac McLaren. And after Isaac got sober in AA, they sent him over here to Yale University in America, where he graduated as a psychiatrist and psychologist. He was a long time sober then. I went down and spoke to Isaac about the fourth step, you know, and he said, "Well, Willie, if you're looking for advice in the fourth step," he said, "I would assume that you've taken the third step." And I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Tell me how you did it." And I told him that I knelt down in my bedroom. And he said, "Okay." He said, "Do you mind if we do it again?" And the two of us knelt down and we said the third step prayer. And whenever we stood up, he looked at me and he said, "Well, if you're sincere about the decision you've just made," he said, "by now you should be trusting in God." He said, "And all you have to do from today on is just learn to accept everything that happens to you today, the good and the bad. Don't argue, don't struggle, don't fight it. Just accept it as being God's will for you, just for today." And then he said, "And do the same thing tomorrow." And I remember looking at him and thinking, "Shit, that'll never work. But I'm going to try it, just to prove him wrong." And I've been doing that now for the last 26 days, and 8 months, and 26 years. And it's never wrong. And I dare you to try it. It's incredible. If anybody would have told me, when I started getting sober, the things that would happen in my life, in sobriety, I would have laughed in your face. I really would have. I'm the living proof that this program does work, providing we follow the directions in this book, because that is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the book that gave the fellowship its name. The book came first. So that day he said to me, "Well," I said, "if you're looking for advice in the fourth step," and at that time in our area, some of the people had started handing out the Joe and Charlie four-step inventory guides, and I took a set of them down with me to let them see them. He'd never seen them before either. This is 1985. And he said to me, "Well," I said, "okay." He said, "but let's see what it says in the book about the fourth step." And he showed me the lines in the book, and it says that you might not overcome drinking until you tell someone else all your life story. Then he said to me, he said, "I don't want you to tell me anything today." He said, "Go home and get a writing pad and start writing down everything you can remember up until you were 15. And again, You know what it says in chapter 5 that somebody's we bought. I remember saying to him, wait a wee minute, pal. I didn't start drinking until I was 21, 22. He just smiled. He said, Willie, go home and get a writing pad and write down the things you can remember up to you were 15. And when I was leaving, he said, now, it's not a race. Take your time. It was incredible, the things that happened over the next few weeks. Some of the memories that come back to me, even from my childhood, things that I was convinced that I'd forgotten all about, and I would just jot them down, then I could expand on them later on. It took me about a month to write down the first part of it, the first episode, and I went down and shared it with him. And he was able to point out to me at that time that I suffered from the effects of the illness of alcoholism through my parents, through all their drinking. And then again, you know, he said to me, he said, I want you to continue doing the same thing for the rest of your life, but just do it in 5-year cycles, from your 15 to your 20, then 20 to your 25. And he said, I've got no idea the things that you might tell me that happened to you later on in life when you left school, you got married, you moved down to London. He said, but you worked in the gambling industry. I said, yep. He said, all right. He said, I'll have a bet with you right now that it's just a repetition of everything you did up until you were 15. And again, I remember looking at him and thinking, are you in for a surprise, pal? The things I've done. But you know, he was dead right. Because even up to the age of 15, I was a thief and a liar and a cheat and a con artist. And I used and abused people right, left and centre, women in particular. You know, and that's the kind of guy I was. And I thought I was okay. I realise today, you know, I was never punished for my sins. I was punished by my sins. And I was the one that punished myself. After I finished all that, I shared my fifth step with Andy Davidson, rather than with Father McLaren. And Andy came to my house on the Sunday morning. And even then, I was still a bit fearful. I was a bit apprehensive, because there were things I had done in my life, mainly to do with sex, that I vowed I would never share with another living soul. I would take them to the grave with me first. And 26 and a half years ago, I nearly did that. But that day when Andy came to my house, and I thank God for him, because before I got a chance to tell Andy anything, Andy shared with me in great depth some of the things that he had done, the exact nature of his wrongs. And really, that's what gave me the courage and the confidence to go on and admit the exact nature of my wrongs. That session lasted about 6 hours that day. I remember how I felt. At the end of it, it was a long session. Physically, I felt drained, you know. But mentally or emotionally or spiritually, you know, I felt as high as a kite. I felt clean for the first time in my life. Clean on the inside as well as the outside. It's as if a tremendous weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And I wanted to run out and tell everybody that I'd taken the fifth step. You know, from the wee guy that was apprehensive 6 hours previously, what a change. One of the things I did forget to tell you, correct, after Andy introduced me to the book, and I swear to God this is true, I was only 2 weeks sober. 2 weeks. The head case had gone in and out for 12 years. I'm 2 weeks sober. And I'm standing in the main street in the town that I lived in Scotland. And I'm standing speaking to someone. And there was no blinding flashes of light or burning bushes. It was just a quiet feeling that I had in my head and in my heart. And I knew then that the obsession to drink was gone. I knew it. And I can't explain it to you any better than I've just done. But from that day till this, that horrible craving for a drink has never came back. And I was even scared to tell anybody about that. And I waited till I was about 6 months sober. And I'd never been 6 months sober in my life. But I was scared to tell people in case I would drink again and they would laugh at me again. Because I'm sure in some of the meetings they used, I know for a fact they would say to me, oh, how long are you back for this time, Willie? You know, that's just how bad it was. That's why I say I'll probably qualify for the Guinness Book of Records. Taking the fifth step was a tremendous relief to me. Then it comes to step 6 and 7 in the book. And 6, this program is no big deal, providing we follow the directions in the book. Step 6 and 7 is just a prayer. It says, "My Creator, I am now willing that you shall have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray you now remove." And at the end of it, it says, "We have now completed step 7. It's only it's only 8 lines in the book. That then brings me on to step 8. And I had just finished my 4 steps so I could make the list of the people that had harmed. And I remember at that time, you know, I felt so ashamed when I looked at the number of people that I had harmed. I probably harmed every living soul that I ever came in contact with. Mainly through my attitudes. I may have hurt some of them mentally, physically, emotionally, financially, sexually, you name it. But I remember saying to Andy Davison that day, "Andy, I can't do this. I can't do this." And he said, "What do you mean you can't do it?" I said, "I wish to God they would have left out the last word. Because in step 8 it says, we became willing to make amends to them all." And I remember saying to Andy, "There is one guy in that list that I'll never make amends to him. I'll never make amends to him." As I told you, in 1971 I was in a car accident. I remember being given the last rites by a Catholic priest. Over the time I was in that hospital, 4.5 months, that priest, he was the hospital chaplain from St Mungo's Parish in Townhead in Glasgow. And he used to come over and sit with me at night, a lot of nights. And I poured my soul out to this guy, my heart and my soul to him. After I was discharged from hospital, you know, he used to come out and visit me and my wife and kids on his day off, and it became maybe once a month, then it would be once a week, then it was 2 or 3 nights a week. We drank together. He would come out, you know, with his briefcase and open it and come out with a bottle of whiskey, and the little white plastic thing would come off and get chucked in the corner, and I'd come out with a bottle of whiskey and the two of us would sit there drinking half the night. And after me and my ex-wife split up, that priest married my wife. And I remember a few years previously when I suspected there was something going on, I remember going down to the place where he was staying, and I took him outside in the front garden and I said to him, "You know, if ever I see you in this area again, I'll put this car right over the earth on top of you." And he knew I meant it. And I'm not proud when I tell you that the last few years of especially my mother's life, my mother lived in abject terror that I was going to end up in prison doing a life sentence. Because my family knew, you know, the amount of violence that I was capable of. So I said to Andy, "You know, I'll never make amends to that guy." And Andy said to me, "Will I pray for him?" I remember looking at Andy and saying, "Pray for him? Pray for him?" I'd bury him in my front garden. And Andy said, "Well, it's up to you." He said, "If you don't, you'll drink again." And that's what really stopped me short. Because I didn't ever want to go back to the hell that I'd come out of. And I started praying for that man. I didn't mean it at first. But gradually I kept doing it. Until the day came, it took a few years. When I would ask my God to give that guy the same gifts and blessings as he'd given me. Incredible. He died a few years ago and I got a chance to make direct amends to him face to face before he died. In the 9th step, it talks about making direct amends, and that means, for me, it means face to face. It's not about running around knocking on doors and saying, "I'm sorry." I'd said I was sorry a million times, never meant it once. You know, but this was different. And to the best of my ability, I've made direct amends to a lot of people that I'd harmed. There are still people on my list that I don't even know where they are, you know. But I've done as much as I can do. Most of the people that I made direct amends to, they all accepted it with good grace. But some of them said, "You just get the F out my road. We don't ever want to see you again." And I don't blame them. I don't blame them, not one little bit. I try and live every day in my life today by step 10, 11 and 12, because that's what it tells me in this book. And it tells me if there's anything bothering me today, and it can only be one of 4 things: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment and fear. And it tells me what to do about them. And I try it every day, and I fail every day. But I keep on trying, and that's the secret for me. Step 11 talks about prayer and meditation. I don't go in for a lot of organized, ritualized prayers. You know, I talk to my God just the way I talk to you. I call him my silent partner, and I take him with me everywhere I go. You know, there are a few prayers that I use, like the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer and the prayer of St. Francis. And I remember there's a guy called St. Augustine. Over here you all call him St. Augustine. He's got a big cathedral out in the East Coast. But his name's St. Augustine. And if you ever read his book, The True Confessions of St. Augustine, he was one of us. He was into wine, women and song every night of the week. And every night before he would go to bed, he would kneel down and he would say, "Father, make me a saint, but not yet." And I heard Father Ed Dowling saying, "You know, if he ever gets to heaven, it will only be from backing away from hell." You know, there's quite a number of little prayers that are meaningful to me. Over the time I've been sober, I've read quite a number of spiritual books, and they're all good, but nothing can touch this one. You can only imagine the amount of anger and hatred that I had against that particular priest and about the Catholic Church in general. But again, this book, that saved my life on that occasion as well, because in there it says that we beg you to lay aside any prejudice you may have, even against organized religion, that we usually seek out the wrongdoings of one or two individuals and use that as a basis of wholesale condemnation of them all. And that's what I'd be doing. I'll take you back to 1994. I started coming over here to Orlando 20 years ago. And I would come twice a year. I'd come for the whole month of July. And I'd come back again for 3 months in the winter before Christmas. So much I could tell you, but I'm restricted by time. But in 1994, I was over here in the winter for 3 months. I went back to Glasgow, and I went to the usual Monday night meeting I'd been going to for years. And I knew most of the people in the room, but this particular night, there was a big guy sitting down the bottom of the room. And I got my cup of tea, and I went down and introduced myself. And as soon as I heard, he opened his mouth, and he said, "My name is John." And I could hear the American accent. And I remember saying to him, "You know, are you here on vacation, John?" And he said, "No." He said, "I'm here as part of my job." So, of course, the next question is, "What do you work at?" And he said, "I'm a Catholic priest." And some of my friends that are here tonight, they got a chance to meet him here in St. Cloud 2 weeks ago. Jim spent the day with him just last week. He was down staying with me. And that night after the meeting, he asked me for my phone number. And he called me the next day, and he asked me if I would sponsor him. And he's 35 years sober. As I say, the amount of anger and resentment I had against priests, that could only happen in AA. Imagine me being asked to sponsor a priest. Don't tell me this program doesn't work. And God's got a fabulous sense of humor. He really has. And he's a sucker for gratitude. And this is a gratitude banquet. And I can assure you, I've got a tremendous amount to be grateful for. One of the main things I have to be grateful for is the life that I have today. And I love being alive today. And my God knows just how much I wanted to die. It brought me on to the 12th step. And that's part of the reason why I'm here tonight. Because in there it says, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. The result of these steps is a spiritual awakening. I have had many, many, many spiritual awakenings. I'd keep you here for the next 3 hours. Trust me, you know, but I won't. It says that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message. And every meeting I go to, I listen intently to people reading out the 12 steps. because I believe that the words in this, in our program, are very precise and they are very specific. And in the 12 steps, we're asked to try to carry this message, not the message. And Andy Davison, God bless him again, Andy showed me this in the book, and this is the third edition, and it's the inside of the fly cover about halfway down, and it says that this is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, that pages 1 through 164 remains unchanged. Then it says, this is the AA message. For some reason, GSO have taken it out of the fourth edition. It's not in there. Just go and ask them about it. And that... I've said it for years. I believe that I have become everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever want to be. I don't want to be chairman of this or delegate to that, you know. I'm a message boy. That's all I am. But what a fabulous message we're asked to carry. And if I don't know what it says in the first 164 pages of this book, how in the name of God can I try and carry this message? You see, then they go even further, because they asked me to try and practice principles in all my affairs. I used to think that word affairs meant affairs. During the 12 years I was going in and out, you know, at one point they suggested to me that I join a group and get involved. And I joined a group and I got involved all right, and she was gorgeous. And I walked out and I left my wife and my three kids and I moved in with her. And that lasted a couple of months, and within a few hours the two of us were drunk. And it took the cops to split us up. That's how bad that was. That's a nightmare scenario. And if you want to know more about that one, I'll talk to you outside. But you know, now I'm being asked to try and practice principles in my life. And for me, you know, a spiritual life is just trying to lead a clean, decent, honest life. That's it. The kind of life I should have been living all my life, but I didn't know it. I was always looking for the easier, softer ways. Every bookmaker that I ever worked for, you know, and I'm not bragging or boasting when I tell you, they all thought the world of this wee guy. I've got a brain like a computer, and I've known that since I was that size, and that's a gift from God. I know that. And all these bookmakers that I worked for, they thought the world of me, and I robbed every one of them blind. Every one of them. You know, I never get caught once. Not once. You know? Practice these principles in all our affairs. Yeah. I'd like to take you back now to like the summer of 1998. After me and my wife got divorced, a couple of years later, they then applied to the Vatican to have my marriage annulled. And again, I went down and I spoke to Isaac McLaren about it, and Father McLaren said to me, Willie, he said, the Catholic Church is very slow and is very thorough. He said, you know, it could take years. Eventually, I had to go in front of the Scottish Catholic Marriage Tribunal, and they more or less said the same thing. And 2 years later, I got a letter from them saying that my marriage has been annulled. But at that time, I hadn't seen my kids for years. In the summer of 1998, I got a letter from my youngest daughter. Her name's Geraldine. And she told me that she was a patient in St. John's Hospital in Livingston, and she had psychiatric problems, and we were going to see her. I was in that hospital within an hour of getting that letter. And whenever I saw her walking along the corridor, I didn't even recognize her. She was just skin and bone. And she was leaning up against the wall for support, shuffling along. Geraldine had been a nurse. She was only 32. She'd been a nurse and she'd injured her back lifting one of the patients, which is a common complaint with nurses. And because of that, she'd become addicted to prescription drugs. She had never done street drugs, prescription drugs. And she'd been for all sorts of medical tests and scans and x-rays, and they couldn't find anything wrong with her. A few days later, she discharged herself from the hospital. I spent the next 6 months. My business came to a standstill. And I spent the next 6 months with my daughter, either in my house or in her house, every day, trying to help her. And I could never get through to her. I was 13 years sober at the time. Just could not get through to her. She would just say to me, but Dad, I don't feel safe. You know, And I would talk to her about, you know, the peace of mind and happiness and contentment I had. And she was saying, but Dad, you know, I'll never have peace of mind and happiness. On the 2nd of January 1999, I was asked to speak at a meeting in Cumbernauld, where Chris and Harry are from. And I remember that night in the meeting, I was telling the people in the room about my daughter. And I remember saying that I had to admit that I was powerless over Geraldine, and she made my life unmanageable. And I came to believe that only a power greater than me could restore her to sanity. And I made a decision that night to turn her will and her life over to the care of my God, as I understood him. That was Saturday, the 2nd of January, 1999. On the Tuesday afternoon, I got a phone call from my son, again, that I hadn't seen for years, to tell me that Geraldine was dead. She'd hanged herself. That was on the Tuesday afternoon. We didn't get the autopsy report till the next day. And that's when they confirmed that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Saturday night. The night that I had turned her will and her life over to the care of my God. At that time, I had a lot of my own family and friends in my house every night. I had quite a number of AA members all came to my house. And again, I needed all that support. But you know, they would all go home about 11 or 12 o'clock at night because they had their own families and jobs and what have you to go to. And I thank God at that time for all the friends that I had over here, because when it's midnight in Scotland, it's only 7 o'clock in the evening over here. And I was on the phone every night of the week to my friends here in Orlando, in Melbourne, in Naples, in West Palm Beach, and Father John up in Washington, D.C. You know, and I broke my heart crying. And the day of the funeral, the day before the funeral, I was in my ex-wife's house, and that guy that married her, he was there. And Andy Davison was with me. And you know, my ex-wife had spent years turning my kids against me, and you know, I could sense the atmosphere as I walked into that room that they were probably all thinking, oh, here's the lunatic, here he comes, you know. And I went around every one of them and I shook their hands and I said to them, you know, I'm Geraldine's dad. I'm her dad. Because this other guy for years, he was trying to give them the impression that he was the father. The next day at the funeral, that man got up on the altar to give a eulogy about his darling daughter Geraldine, and I'm sitting there, and it's my daughter. It's unbelievable the things that man said, you know, but I have to learn to forgive that as well and to let it go. But the main thing is, during all that trauma that was going on in my life at that time, the thought for a drink never even crossed my mind. That's a fact. For the next 12 months, it's as if I'd been hit by a series of express trains. I lost two of my sisters to this disease. I lost another one later on, but during that 12-month period, I lost another two of my sisters. One of them, my eldest sister, Kathleen, she'd been to AA. And she kept on drinking, and you know, the doctors told her 6 months before she died that she had to stop drinking right now. But Kathleen kept on drinking, and eventually her body blew apart. And one of my other sisters, her name's Pat. Pat ended up with what they call Korsakoff psychosis. It's a wet brain. And it took my sister Pat about 3 years to die. And I was with her most of the time before she did. And that's horrific, if any of you have seen that. Excuse me. The man that I stayed with every year in Orlando, Jack, at that time, Jack's wife died. She took 5 heart attacks in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, and she never came out of it. The friends that I stayed with down in Naples in Florida, Joe Kelly and his wife Deborah, some of you might know them, they used to run the state conventions in the registry. I was with Joe Kelly's wife Deborah the day that she died, on the 9th of January 2000. There was another young guy that worked for me. He'd been to AA. He committed suicide. I had a nephew committed suicide. This is all within that 12-month period. It was unbelievable. But again, the miracle of AA, the thought of a drink, never crossed my mind. Now, I don't tell you these things looking for sympathy. The reason why I'm telling you these things is, if this program can work for somebody like me, it will work for anyone. It will work for anyone. And people wonder why I feel so passionate about AA. As I said earlier, my whole life today centers around AA. When I started getting sober at first, I told you I was managed to borrow some cassettes of John Charlie. Over a period, I ended up with a good fair-sized collection of cassettes. And I used to sit at home 16 hours a day making copies of these cassettes and giving them out to people in the meetings just to try and encourage them. I retired and came to live over here permanently 6 years ago. And I've since graduated from cassettes to CDs to DVDs. And I've been doing this for 26 years. And I've never charged anyone a penny for anything I do. Because that's what it tells me in this book. It says, give freely of what you find and join us. I'm not too much in favour of people who make a business out of AA. I don't go for that at all. And I love doing what I'm doing. You've all probably heard of a man called Chuck Chamberlain. He was a tremendous help to me when I started getting sober. I've had thousands of sponsors in AA. Most of them I've never ever met. A lot of them are dead. It's people that I've listened to on cassettes or CDs. And I've actually met some of them in the last few years since I've been over here. Incredible stuff. But, I stole Chuck Chamberlain's philosophy of living when I heard him saying that he just likes to help people to do things that they want to get done because he enjoys doing it for free and for fun. And that's what I do. And I feel that I have been vastly overpaid for anything that I do in AA. My God is a sucker for gratitude. He really is. He will not be outdone in anything. Nothing. The life I have today is great. I just lead a very busy, quiet life. There's people in this room tonight who know me. They know some of the things that I do. And there's one guy in particular, he came into my life about 3-4 years ago, and I've got no wish to embarrass him, but it's Jim sitting down here. And the friendship that I have with Jim has been absolutely incredible, and Jim has helped me in so many different ways by opening doors for me that I could never have reached, and we get on all right in spite of the fact that he's Irish. Boy says he is. Scott's in the same mold. Scott's a bit like me. Scott's a go-getter. And that's what I like to see in people. I like to just try and encourage people to. There's a lot more to Alcoholics Anonymous than just don't drink and go to meetings. There's a hell of a lot more. I don't use the word miracle lightly, but some of the things that have happened in my life have been absolutely incredible, and I wouldn't change it for anyone. I often wonder, in controlled imagination, what some of our co-founders would say tonight if they were in this room. And somehow I can hear Dr. Silkworth saying, I urge every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps you came to scoff, you may remain to pray. I can hear Bill Wilson saying, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Then he says it's the purpose of this book to answer these questions specifically. Dr. Bob, the quiet man in AA, you don't hear too much about him, but what a tremendous example he was. And I feel that if he were here tonight, he would probably say, you know, if you think that you're an atheist or an agnostic or a skeptic or suffer from any other form of intellectual pride which prevents you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. And personally, so do I. I'm going to finish this up now by using the words of my first sponsor, Father McLeod. And Isaac would always finish the meetings by saying that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't come into existence to make life easy, but it did come into existence to make men and women great. And I would like to thank each and every one of you tonight, personally, for listening to me. Because tonight, again, I feel great. Thanks for my life.